In 1987, Margaret Thatcher said, "There is no such thing as society. There are individual men and women, and there are families." This short phrase proved to be one of the most infamous quotes of her career. To Thatcher's critics, it was an expression of the callousness and cold-heartedness that typified her time as Prime Minister, and this view became so closely entwined with her image and the image of the Conservative Party generally that when David Cameron became party leader almost 20 years later, he felt compelled to revise it, saying, "There is such a thing as society. It's just not the same thing as the state." The quote itself, however, is often taken out of context. It was actually an off-the-cuff remark that Thatcher gave during an interview to Women's Own magazine. The full extract reads,
"I think we have gone through a period when too many children and people have been given to understand, 'I have a problem, it is the government's job to cope with it,' or 'I have a problem, I will go and get a grant to cope with it. I am homeless, the government must house me,' and so they are casting their problems on society, and who is society? There is no such thing. There are individual men and women, and there are families, and no government can do anything except through people, and people look to themselves first. It is our duty to look after ourselves, and then also to help look after our neighbor, and life is a reciprocal business, and people have got the entitlements too much in mind without the obligations, because there is no such thing as an entitlement unless someone has first met an obligation. There is no such thing as society. There is a living tapestry of men and women and people, and the beauty of that tapestry and the quality of our lives will depend on how much each of us is prepared to take responsibility for ourselves, and each of us is prepared to turn around and help by our own efforts those who are unfortunate."
Chernobyl was a TV miniseries produced by HBO and Sky and created by Craig Mazin. It aired in the first half of 2019 and was really good. It starred Jared Harris, Emily Watson and Stellan Skarsgård and was nominated for several Emmys, which I think is some kind of award for old media. The show dramatizes a set of real-life events from 1986, which happened in, Germany? I think it was Germany. I wasn't really paying attention. And it was some kind of accident at a factory. I don't really remember, but based on the way they were dressed, I think they were all supposed to be bakers. Bakers. And they have to bake some very important cookies or something. So the oven where these German bakers are baking the cookies explodes. And that's very bad because the cookie dough goes everywhere. And eating raw cookie dough can make you sick. So if it spreads across Europe, everybody could get food poisoning. And all the German scientists and bakers have to figure out what they're going to do about it. And a lot of the people who are in a position to do something deny the problem. You'd think that a nuclear reactor exploding would be pretty hard to miss, but they say no, it was just a hydrogen tank going pop. The radiation levels are safe. It's nothing to worry about. They don't want to face the facts because that might mean that they are responsible. The Soviets kind of had their own version of fake news. They called it alarmism. And a lot of the people who say, "No, look, the reactor has clearly exploded. There's radiation spewing out. If we don't do something about it, all of Europe is going to end up uninhabitable." They get dismissed as alarmists.
"Look, that's graphite on the roof. The whole building's been blown open. The core's exposed.
I can't see how you can tell that from here."
"Oh, for God's sakes. Look at that glow. That's radiation ionizing the air."
"Well, if we can't see, we don't know."
"Seymour, the house is on fire!"
"No, Mother, it's just the Northern Lights."
The protagonist of the series, Professor Valery Legazov, is portrayed as being the one sane man, trying to contain the disaster before it's too late. As the old saying goes, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is called a virtue signaler and a sight cuck. In terms of who gets the most bad guy coded screen time, the show seems to be leading us towards suspecting this dude, Anatoly Dyatlov, as being the main culprit. He was in charge on the night and he made a bunch of very dangerous decisions which created the conditions for the accident. And according to both the show and several distinguished historians, he was also a massive f***ing dickhead.
"Shut the f*** up and do your job."
"What did you do?"
"Found out where the f*** did you get this job?"
Then this chick comes up to me and she's all like, "Hey, aren't you that dude?" I'm like, "Yeah, whatever."
"I apologize."
Although, the show also demonstrates that it's not entirely Dyatlov's fault. In real life, they were running a safety test when Chernobyl exploded. So a lot of the usual fail-safes had been turned off as part of it. And Dyatlov was under pressure from his bosses to just get it done so they could all get promoted. But it had to be delayed, and then there was a shift change, so the new guys coming in didn't really know what they were doing. There was also a crucial design flaw with the reactor that caused it to explode when they pushed the emergency shutdown button. And even though a lot of scientists actually knew about that design flaw for years beforehand, it had been covered up by the government. Depending on how you read it, you could also say that the show blames socialism a little bit. Creator Craig Mazin has said that he wanted to tell a story about lies, which he says is relevant to contemporary America as much as it is Soviet Russia. But some commentators have jumped at the chance to read a more partisan message into it, especially since usually about once per episode, some character all but turns the camera and goes, "Did you know the Soviet Union was bad?"
I'm a nuclear physicist. Before you were deputy secretary, you worked in a shoe factory.
Yes, I worked in a shoe factory. And now I'm in charge. To the workers of the world.
And that is the outlook espoused by Labour leader Jeremy Gore.
So Chernobyl poses some interesting philosophical questions about responsibility and people's relationships to the societies they live in. And in case you think this is just like a one-time event that can't teach us much now, there are a lot of parallels between the Chernobyl nuclear disaster and, say, the American AIDS crisis of the 1980s. It's another scenario where scientists were fighting against an invisible enemy and the government didn't want to listen, so people died. Or, kind of an obvious parallel, I guess, climate change. Something a little closer to home for me, though. The Grenfell fire. In 2017, a tower block in Kensington caught fire and 72 people died. Kensington's a pretty posh bit of London, but the tower was mainly social housing, so there's a lot of people from low-income families and a lot of people of colour. It was later discovered that the outside of the tower was covered in flammable cladding that allowed the flames to spread way beyond what the interior was designed to cope with. That cladding had been installed the year before, and the reason they went with the flammable one is the local council had outsourced management of its social housing to another body who decided that the flammable stuff was cheaper. Despite being warned that it was dangerous, and despite the residents of the tower saying for years that the fire safety measures were inadequate, all of that occurred against the background of Conservative and Liberal Democrat governments cutting public spending in response to the 2008 financial crash, a group of policies known as austerity. Some of the survivors were reluctant to speak up for fear of being deported, which exists against the background of my country having gotten very hostile to migrants in the last few years. And as of April this year, some survivors still hadn't been rehoused, and some towers still have that flammable cladding on. Just like the Chernobyl disaster was in the minds of some people a symbol of the late Soviet Union, the Grenfell fire became a kind of symbol of contemporary Britain.
Is this really the way it all works? An uninformed, arbitrary decision that will cost who knows how many lives made by some apparatchik, some career party man?
Also, just as a side note, this doesn't really have anything to do with the philosophy, but the acting in this show is really good, especially the physical acting. A lot of people think acting for camera just happens in shots like this, from the shoulders up, or sometimes close-up and extreme close-up, because that shows you what we in the acting industry call the face, technical term. But really, acting takes your whole body. Look at this scene here. Even with the audio removed, you can tell so much about the characters just from their body language. And this great, cute little moment where Professor Legazov doesn't know where to stand? The actress had a dedicated movement coach, Imogen Knight, and she did so f***ing good. Oh, you know what else is excellent? The casting. Look at this quick scene where Legazov is buying cigarettes and he meets a character who we've never seen before and who we never see again. This guy. This guy right here, he's only in the series for like 4 seconds. He has no lines, just this one shot, but you only have to look at him and you know he's a KGB agent. He has the most KGB ass face of any motherfucker I've ever seen. I looked him up. His name is Simonos Davidoskas. Simonos, mate, you fucking nailed it. Also, one last thing, I promise, the direction. There are a lot of shots in this where it looks like they didn't use a tripod. Like, I think these shots are handheld. You can see how the frame moves around. In this scene, Emily Watson's character, Ulana Komyuk, is trying to convince Professor Legazov to do something dangerous where they don't know what the outcome will be. The characters are emotionally unsteady and visually unsteady within the frame. Whereas here, at the end, when Legazov and Shabina are more secure in their friendship and at peace with what's going to happen to them, the shots are locked off. It's the little details like this that really make the show worth watching.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Does it make sense to say that the Chernobyl disaster was the fault of Soviet society? Or that the Grenfell fire was the fault of this one? One of the potential problems with saying that is that it might let people who are more guilty off the hook. Like, isn't Dyatlov obviously more responsible for Chernobyl than society? If we start believing in collective responsibility, then how can we ever say that one person is better or worse than anybody else? We've lost the whole basis of moral judgment. That's actually the question posed by a very famous scene in the film Judgment at Nuremberg.
Germany alone is not guilty. The whole world is as responsible for Hitler's Germany. It is an easy thing to condemn one man in the dark. It is easy to condemn the German people, to speak of the basic flaw in the German character that allowed Hitler to rise to power, but at the same time, comfortably ignore the basic flaw of character that made the Russians sign pacts with him, Winston Churchill praise him, American despots profit by him. Ernst Janning said, he is guilty. If he is, Ernst Janning's guilt is the world's guilt.
And so isn't the only answer to keep the blame with individuals? Yes, Dyatlov was under pressure, but isn't he an adult with free will, not just a cog in a machine? Just 1 year after the real Nuremberg trials, the philosopher H.D. Lewis wrote, "If there are no such distinctions, if the questions we ask about them are without substance, then the greater part of ethical controversy has been a peculiarly vain pursuit of a will-o'-the-wisp." I love the flair for the dramatic that a lot of those early 20th century British philosophers had in their writing. That's just such a will-o'-the-wisp. It's such a nice little sentence. Although, maybe collective responsibility isn't as weird as it seems. The philosopher Fareed Abdelnour points out that people say stuff like, "We won the war. We put a man on the moon. We beat Tottenham 1-0. When, actually, as individuals, we didn't have anything to do with it. And if we can take pride in our nation or our team's accomplishments, why not also take responsibility for their failures? The psychologist Daniel Kahneman pointed out that we do something kind of similar with companies as well. If you have a bad experience where a representative of, say, Ryanair is rude to you, people will often say, "Ryanair was really rude to me." We hold the whole collective responsible. But is that the same thing? Just because we can feel proud or ashamed of a group doesn't mean that we take on their moral responsibility. Lewis says, even if you practically agree to answer for somebody else's actions, like a parent might take responsibility for their child, you can't actually take on somebody else's moral guilt. Unless you're Jesus. And even then, it's a massive pain in the ass. Although we may be proud or ashamed of others, we add not a cubit to our stature. Neither do we shrink through our association with them, except in the measure that we ourselves change under their influence. You can almost smell the pipe smoke and tweed on that one.
Dark academia.
That said, there are some more modern examples where being strictly individualist about responsibility gets kind of tricky, like with so-called self-driving cars. Let's say that you are driving along and a kid runs out in front of you and you swerve to avoid them and you hit somebody else. You can be taken to court to answer for that decision. It might turn out that you haven't done anything wrong, but you can still be held accountable. But now let's say you weren't driving. Let's say that it was a self-driving car. In that case, the decision to swerve wasn't made in the moment. It was made months ago by whoever programmed it to perceive objects and have goals in the way that it does. So-called autonomous systems still do what they are told to do. They aren't really autonomous. They're just unsupervised. A person still has to tell it what its goal is and how to gather and interpret the data that they use to achieve it. So if you get hit by a self-driving car, can you take the car company to court? Because if not, then that company has just been given the unaccountable power of life and death over everybody who encounters their product. So we're sort of stuck, because it isn't clear that there is an individual responsible there. But at the same time, saying that seems to let somebody somewhere off the hook. Elaine Herzberg was hit and killed by one of Uber's unsupervised vehicles in 2018. Some human being is responsible for this woman's death. Whether that amounts to criminal responsibility, we now can't know because her family settled with Uber out of court. But the companies that make these systems, whether for cars, military, whatever, have a very strong incentive to tell you that they're autonomous, because that conceals the fact that really they are responsible for what their machines do. And there are some other scenarios where being strictly individualist about responsibility gets tricky as well. Something that comes up a lot in the philosophical literature is, do people alive now have any kind of responsibility for historical crimes? Like, do white people owe reparations for slavery? The official woke SJW party line on this is that if you are benefiting from a historical injustice, you have a responsibility to set it right, even if you didn't personally do the bad thing. But the philosopher Jana Thompson asks, why? Why does benefiting from it make me responsible? Liable? What? For a crime that I didn't commit? Something I notice reading more conservative philosophers is a lot of them worry about punishment. Jan Narveson is an anarcho-capitalist who says that any talking about group benefit or oppression is going to wind up with somebody getting punished for a crime they didn't commit. I've seen people in my comments section get quite heated if they suspect that they're being blamed or told to feel guilty for being white. One of the things about being white in a country like mine is you don't often have to think about it, because race isn't usually made a problem for us. So when we do get invited to think about it, a lot of us jump to that very defensive position of trying to avoid blame first and fix the problem second.
Don't worry, we did everything right. Something strange is happening.
I have a list of individuals who we believe are accountable.
This phenomenon even has a name, white fragility, a name seemingly designed to annoy the very people most in need of understanding it. But Thompson points out that a lot of the time, when people talk about historical crimes and the responsibility for setting them right, it's not really about individual blame and punishment. It's about the redistribution of resources. So no wonder so many people are suspicious of the question. Not only is there a high potential for misinterpreting it as a personal attack, but the real issue is actually deeply political.
So everything's my fault then? Is that what this is?
I'm not here to blame you. I'm here to find out what happened.
This is bound up with what she calls intergenerational collective responsibility. Sounds really complicated. Don't worry, it isn't. You know the so-called golden rule of morality? Do unto others as you would have them do to you? This is kind of like that, but it's stretched out over time. Someday, I will be an old man who can't take care of himself anymore, and I expect that future people will help me. So I work now, and I pay my taxes, for instance, to do the same thing for people who need help now, because I recognize that their needs and my future needs come from the same place. And personally, I quite like this approach. It comes from a place not of patriotic strength and duty to the nation, but a recognition that we all get sick, we all need education, if we are wronged, we all need justice, if not now, then definitely someday. These intergenerational responsibilities, she says, continue even if the state itself totally changes or collapses. Whether there's a United Kingdom in 2073 or not, and frankly at the moment, who the hell knows, I will be an 80-year-old man and I will need some help because we live in a society. And I think she's hit on something quite interesting here, because it sounds like we're not even talking about moral responsibility anymore. It sounds like we're talking about... Conservatives, like Margaret Thatcher, will sometimes talk about personal responsibility. Like in that interview we opened with, she says she wants more people to be able to buy property. Because you buy a house, you get invested in it, you come to respect other people's property rights, and you become a responsible citizen. She's actually not saying that people should just be thrown to the wolves, even if that was the effect of a lot of her policies. She's saying that if you are freeloading off society, you're really freeloading off other people, so you need to work hard and pull your weight. And there are some big problems with this view, some of which we will get to, but it does have a kind of internal harmony to it, and I can see why some people like it. Canadian author and psychologist Jordan Peterson also talks about the importance of personal responsibility, saying that it gives life meaning, and that we shouldn't languish in our own victimhood, a theme that content creator Stéphane Molyneux also explores. Stéphane hates talking about things like racism and sexism because he thinks they make you a victim. People who fail at life blame the system, they get stuck in the narrative of their own victimization, and they tell you there's no way you can succeed, it's impossible, because they resent the people that do. When really, if you take responsibility for your own life, there's nothing standing in your way. And to give the devil his due, I think that Stéphane kind of has a point when he says that sometimes some people can get a little bit stuck in the victim role. Certainly the abusers I've known have. They refuse to take responsibility for their actions. The real Anatoly Dyatlov maintained to his dying day that he was the victim of a conspiracy and that what happened at Chernobyl was not his fault. I've also been in some online leftist spaces where people are hurting, and in the absence of somewhere to work through that pain, will pour it out into any available container. That's not a uniquely leftist thing, of course. It's just a human thing. So it seems like these thinkers are saying that we should be individualist because it's motivating. And maybe that's why so many people find their work useful. Self-confidence can be massively helpful. If I put on a suit and do the Jordan Peterson stand up straight with his shoulders back thing, it works. Or at least it changes how people respond to me. But I do have a big question about all this. And in order to tease it out, I want to give just one more example. Fred Hess works for a right-wing think tank called the American Enterprise Institute, and he wrote this article about education, saying that students need to take some personal responsibility for their learning. You can't expect the school to do everything for you. And he's surprised that people sometimes push back at him on that. And yeah, I can kind of see where he's coming from. Like, if you're running a school, it doesn't seem unreasonable to expect the students to take responsibility for turning up on time and doing the homework, with allowances for extenuating circumstances, but yeah. Where I get curious, though, is what about expecting them to take responsibility for behaving professionally, or dressing professionally, or being a team player? These are all things that sound like reasonable expectations, but who gets to decide what those mean? And how do they decide? If a black woman puts on a suit and does the Jordan Peterson dance, she might get read as bossy or uppity in a way that I simply never would. And that's the kicker. You think that individual responsibility is how we motivate people to succeed and find meaning? Okay, cool. Succeed at what, though? Meaningful how? Responsible for what exactly? What are your criteria? Who gets to decide them? And are they just? Thatcher's criterion for responsibility was owning property. And the problem there is, that is a thing that is mathematically impossible for everyone to do at the same time. You cannot have a housing market and no homeless people. Because if everybody has secure housing, you cannot sell them housing. So even if everybody is maximally personally responsible and aspirational and striving and all the other Instagram Tory buzzwords, in a competitive system, some of us still have to fail through no fault of our own. Which again is the exact problem that individual responsibility is supposed to solve. It might also be worth noting that individualism isn't the only motivating force. During the Chernobyl disaster, a lot of people did incredibly brave and dangerous things to fight the radiation, often knowingly shortening their own lives out of a sense of what Craig Mazin calls Soviet civic duty.
The reactor fuel is going to sink into the ground and poison the water from Kiev to the Black Sea. All of it. Forever, they say. They want you to stop that from happening.
How are we supposed to do that?
They didn't tell me, because I don't need to know. Do you need to know, or have you heard enough?
You'll do it, because nobody else can. But if you don't, millions will die. If you tell me that's not enough, I won't believe you.
So we're sort of stuck again. But it's the interesting kind of stuck this time, rather than the frustrating kind. The philosopher Deborah Tollefson says that what it means to hold somebody morally responsible is just to have certain feelings about them, like resentment and pride or disappointment and so on. It's not really about the logical relations of responsibility and personhood. It's more like telling a story about our feelings and our demands about how other people should be treated. Philosophers call this expressivism. Tollefson says that moral responsibility talk isn't really trying to be rigorous philosophy. It's a kind of storytelling. When people say that Chernobyl or Grenfell is society's fault, what they're really saying is, I think we should change society. And the opposite, when people say we should focus on individuals and personal responsibility only, is kind of like saying, no, I don't think we should change society. So maybe the main lesson of Chernobyl is that you should always be nice to people, because if things do go south, they'll find it a lot easier to blame you if they already think you're a twat.
Officer Leroy comes up and he's like, hey, I thought I told you, and I'm like, yeah, what up?
That would explain why discussions about historical reparations can get so fraught. It would explain why your Jordan Petersons and your Stefans Molyneux talk about personal responsibility without really digging into the philosophical depth. It would explain how the Daily Express somehow managed to blame the Chernobyl disaster on Jeremy Corbyn.
Marxist ideologue!
The true death toll of Chernobyl is not only unknown, but unknowable. The radiation spread across Europe, and of everybody who's died of cancer since 1986, there's no answer to the question how many might have lived had the reactor not exploded. If we can't even calculate the damage, how can we assign responsibility? All we have is the story. And insofar as Grenfell is a symbol of austerity in my country, there's no way of knowing how many people were killed by those policies. How many thousands died after having their disability benefits withdrawn? How many people killed themselves through poverty and desperation or whose lives were shortened by stress? Many of us now know what some experts warned at the time, that austerity was harmful and ultimately pointless. But many of the policies are still in place, and many of the people who designed and implemented them are walking around freely at time of recording. And it's even harder to tell stories about that because it's so spread out. The stories that we have told about austerity tend to focus on individuals and make them the symbol for us all, like in the incredible 2016 film I, Daniel Blake. But will there ever be a memorial for the victims of austerity, the way that there is for Chernobyl? Whether you think somebody's responsible or whether there's anything to be responsible for depends on what sort of story you want to tell. Interestingly, Chernobyl reflects on storytelling and responsibility in the ways it departs from history. Unlike most of the other people depicted, Emily Watson's character, Ulana Komyuk, was not a real historical figure. She was written to represent the dozens of other scientists that helped contain the disaster, because having one person to praise makes for a more understandable story. And the ending reflects it too. In the final episode, Legazov has to decide whether to reveal to the scientific community that the fault in the reactor design was covered up. There are multiple other reactors in the Soviet Union, all with the same flaw, each another potential Chernobyl. But embarrassing the government could be even worse for his health than the radiation.
What you're proposing is that Legasov humiliate a nation that is obsessed with not being humiliated.
In a dramatic final speech, Legasov tells the story of what happened at Chernobyl and unveils the conspiracy.
And then, as punishment, the KGB cancels him and forces him to delete his Twitter account.
Your testimony today will not be accepted by the state. It will not be disseminated in the press. It never happened. No one will talk to you. No one will listen to you. No friends. Other men, lesser men, will receive credit for the things you have done.
This also never happened. Legazov wasn't even at the trial. And contrary to the show's portrayal of a scientific community hungry for the truth and the KGB trying to repress it, in reality, Legazov's fellow scientists ostracized him and knowingly participated in the cover-up. But having a clearly identifiable hero, villain, and timeline of events helps tell a better story, and better motivates people to learn the lessons the show's creators want us to learn.
What is the cost of lies? It's not that we'll mistake them for the truth. The real danger is that if we hear enough lies, then we no longer recognize the truth at all. What can we do then? What else is left but to abandon even the hope of truth and content ourselves instead with stories? In these stories, it doesn't matter who the heroes are. All we want to know is who is to blame.
What is happening in there?
Aurora Borealis?
Aurora Borealis. At this time of year, at this time of day, in this part of the country, localized entirely within your kitchen.
Yes.
May I see it?
No.